Page 49, Changes in the Structure of Political Compromise by Otto Kirchheimer. This article, first published in Studies in Philosophy and Social Sciences, Volume Roman 9 in 1941, traces the transition from liberal capitalism to organized capitalism, monopoly, capitalism, and national socialism from the viewpoint of the crucial institutions of political compromise. Here we have one of the few political sociological attempts from within critical theory to explain the institutional context of the world historical transition presupposed, for example, by Horkheimer's End of Reason. Kirchheimer indeed gives us empirical documentation of the generic links between pluralist mass democracy and the fascist state. Nevertheless, it is a special virtue of his essay that it does not point to a simple or complete convergence of all authoritarian states, unlike some contemporary works of critical theory. Modern political theory has established a close relationship between political compromise and government in a developed industrial society. Footnote 1, text. In this context, compromise means that the foremost political decisions are reached by agreement among individuals as well as among social groups. The following remarks will not evaluate this definition but will try to analyze the conditions and nature of compromises as far as they influenced the European political system under liberalism, mass democracy, and fascism. Page 50. To the latter stages correspond three different types of agreement which have characterized European constitutional history. To liberalism corresponded to the complex of working agreement among parliamentary representatives and between them and the government to mass democracy. The agreements between voluntary associations and to fascism, the pacts by which the heads of the compulsory estates distribute power and booty. Compromise under the representative system and under mass democracy. In his reflection on the French Revolution, Burke, with characteristic vehemence and pointedness, depicts the shift in the location of power to the plutocratic oligarchies, a development which, according to him, had been initiated by the revolutionary policy of confiscation. The volatilization of property, of which this representative of the English landed aristocracy accuses the revolutionary legislator, is responsible for the creation of a commonwealth founded on gaming, in comparison with which, in Burke's opinion, the known scandals of history amount to comparatively little. Footnote 2, text. In all embracing medium of money profoundly conditioned the political institutions of the era. Today we are accustomed to regard money more in its role as one technical means of domination among many. But this purely technical role of money is a phenomenon which did not appear until the monopolistic period. In any case, the 19th century saw the incontestable application of the sociological thesis that the personal security derived from the possession of money was the most concrete form and expression of confidence in the public order. Footnote 3. Text. Possession of money was just as important for the political weight of an individual within the nation as the degree of creditworthiness is for the nation's position in the international concert. Legal equality of citizens and equality of states before international law were the juristic premises of the working of the free exchange process. Footnote 4. Text. An integral part of the representative system was the conception of an agent who was no longer bound by the estates, but who at the same time had not yet become a spokesman tied to definite group interests. The French constitutions of 1791, sections 3, article 7, by denying the admissibility of binding instructions given by the electorate to the representatives, marks the final transitions from the mandat imperatif to the estates to the representative system of the 19th century. Footnote 5. Text. Theories of public law have taken the opportunity to stress the element of freedom contained in the condemnation of the mandat imperatif, this condemnation being the very basis of the representative system. Footnote 6, text. Page 51. In its relatively pure form, the representative system did not prevail in Europe for a particularly long period. Even at the beginning, it was allowed by elements of absolutism and by elements of the still older estate system. Its period of fruition occurred in the second and third quarter of the 19th century when it combined with the doctrine of public opinion. Its territorial extension was confined to those states where there is no honest poverty, where education is diffused and political intelligence common. Footnote 7. Text. That is to say, to the sphere of developing a capitalist economy. With the decline of the central position of money as a universal measuring rod and with the effacement of the correlative independence of representation by the monopolizing society, the remnants of the representative system were becoming rapidly submerged. This process characterized the period of mass democracy. The political system of mass democracy has, as one of its decisive characteristics, the antagonism between public control of government and private control of central banks. The latter had most important public functions. When the central bank legislation of the 19th century took shape, there was no doubt as to the political significance of the administration of this type of joint stock company, on whose wisdom it depends whether a country shall be solvent or insolvent. Footnote 8. Text. Robert Peel, when he introduced the Bank Charter Act of 1844, described the sphere of influence which the domination of the credit apparatus brings with it, and his words show a tendency to reification typical of the period. There is no contract, public or private, no engagement, internal or individual, which is unaffected by it. The bill, the enterprises of commerce, the profits of trade, the arrangement made in all the domestic arrangements of society, the wages of labor, pecuniary transactions of the highest amount and of the lowest, the payment of the national debt, the provision for the national expenditure, the command which the coin of the smallest denomination has over the necessities of life are all affected by the decision to which we may come. Footnote 9. Text. This administration of the central bank, by far the most important office in Great Britain, of those outside the gift of the crown, footnote 10, text, is carried on by officials elected from among the ranks of the banking community. If Brooks Adams appears to have been too pointed in his opinion that the Bank Act of 1844, by yielding the control of the currency to bankers, marked a definite transfer of sovereignty to Lombard Street, footnote 11, text, it is only because in the 19th century there was no serious conflict between Whitehall and Lombard Street. page 52. Since throughout the 19th century the restricted parliamentary franchise did not permit of any disharmony between the interest of the financial community and those of parliamentary government, the relation between the central bank and the government was equally unproblematic. Whether the central bank had statutory independence or whether it was to some extent subject to governmental regulation, this state of affairs was only rarely interrupted. Symptomatically, interruption occurred in 1870 when the defeatist interests of the upper middle class, anxious for the rapid termination of the Franco-Prussian War, found themselves faced by the credit requirements of a government presided over by Gambetta and having a policy of resistance à la entrance. But even in this period of respect for the reputation of the Banque de France, which was supposed to represent public credit, was very high, as may be seen from the humble restraint of the Paris Commune delegate to the bank, footnote 12, text. Even the change in the governorship effected by Gambetta when he returned to power in 1882 had no real significance. Footnote 13, text. In the post-war period of mass democracy, it becomes generally recognized that the complete independence of the central bank as a transmission belt for the financial community can be profitable, used to hold the government and parliament in check. One of the earliest resolutions of the Council of the League of Nations insists on the independence of central banks from governmental interference. Footnote 14, text. The more the respective countries were dependent on outside loans, the more stringent were the requirements for the non-interference of government in the central banks, which in their turn were subjected to a system of mixed control exercised by private national and international financial interests. Thus, the degree of independence of a small country was basically conditional upon whether it had to deal with a unified creditor pool, as Austria had to do with its creditors, pooled under the auspices of the League of Nations, or whether political competitions between prospective creditors nations left the government with a greater amount of liberty of movement in their foreign policy, as in the case of the Balkan nations. The desires and demands of the home banking community were reinforced by the backing of international banking organizations, which, in the personnel of financial commissioners and representatives, resided in the respective capitals themselves, and this was one of the decisive factors favoring or obstructing changes in the political balance in those countries. Footnote 15, text. Page 53. In Germany, the Bank Law of 1924 took most of the powers which the government formerly had exercised and transferred them to the Board of Directors of the Reichsbank, and to a much lesser degree to the internationalized Generalrat and the stockholders. Footnote 16, text. In this new fortified position of the presidency of the Reichsbank very soon became the cohesive organism about which gathered the big financial and industrial interests. It acted as a channel of communications for them and as their accredited representative in their dealings with the government. In this function, for instance, Reichsbank President Schacht was instrumental in barring the cities from further access to the foreign loan market in order to prevent the extension of their successful competition with the privately owned public utilities. Footnote 17, text. This intervention was also felt in the case of the so-called Hilfe-Ding loans, and it was of primary importance in the German crisis of 1929, which led to the downfall of the last parliamentary government, when MacDonald replaced the second Labour cabinet with